From Vermont Public, this is The Frequency. I'm Mitch Wertlieb. It's Thursday, March 28th, and if opening day of the Red Sox season is on your radar, stick around till the end of the podcast. But first, here are today's headlines. Legislation approved by the Vermont House this week would significantly reduce out-of-pocket health care costs for nearly 20,000 low-income seniors. When low-income Vermonters turn 65 years old and qualify for Medicare, they often lose out on some of the benefits they previously enjoyed on Medicaid. Essex Junction Representative Lori Houghton says the transition can add thousands of dollars in health care costs for individuals making as little as $16,000 a year.
People often think when they get to age 65 that Medicare will be great. They have paid into it all their working lives and their health care costs will be covered. But for many, they find their costs actually go up.
The bill would address the issue by expanding eligibility for Medicare subsidies. But House lawmakers want to use an increase in corporate income taxes to pay for the measure, and many Republicans say the plan will drive businesses out of Vermont. The top prosecutor in Addison County has agreed to transfer the case of a 14-year-old accused of murder to juvenile court, that according to a motion filed Monday. Once the case moves to family court, the proceedings will be closed to the public. Addison County State's Attorney Eva Vekos initially brought the case in adult court and filed three felony charges, including second-degree murder. The teen is accused of fatally shooting another 14-year-old in late October. According to a police affidavit, the alleged shooter was waving a loaded pistol in a car when it went off. The decision by Vekos to move the trial to juvenile court came right before the Vermont Supreme Court suspended her law license. The state's highest court made the announcement yesterday. The state panel that regulates lawyers opened an investigation into Vekos after she was charged with driving under the influence and took 3 weeks of medical leave. They asked Vekos to provide information about her leave, and according to the Vermont Supreme Court's order, Vekos did not adequately respond to that request, a violation of the rules governing lawyers' conduct. Vekos' attorney, David Slay, says Vekos now intends to provide more information to the regulatory panel.
Given the direction of the court, we'll comply with that. And then we will seek to vacate the interim suspension.
Vekos pleaded not guilty to the DUI charge in February. That case is still pending. Representative Becca Ballant formally announced yesterday that she will seek a second term in the U.S. House. Ballant made history in 2022 when she became the first woman and openly gay person from Vermont to be elected to Congress. She says her top priorities during her first term have been supporting climate change initiatives, protecting reproductive rights, and working on a Medicare for All healthcare system. Ballant has also been critical of, quote, extreme right-wing House Republicans, who she says have little interest in solving the country's problems.
We can't do any of that if democracy doesn't survive. And I've seen enough this past year and a half to know that that's not an exaggeration. That's not hyperbole.
Ballant says another key priority is her bill to allocate $500 billion in a variety of federal programs to spur the construction of more affordable housing across the country. Coming up, Democrat Moreau Weinberger talks about the ups and downs during his tenure as mayor of Vermont's largest city and what might come next after deciding not to seek a fifth term in Burlington. That's after this.
Thanks for tuning in to The Frequency, and thanks to VITA for their support. VITA, celebrating 50 years of helping Vermont businesses grow and thrive. From agriculture to energy, startups to established companies, find solutions that fit your business. Visit VEDA.org to start your next chapter.
Burlington Mayor Moreau Weinberger has just a few days left in his seat, one he's held for the past 12 years. The city will inaugurate its new mayor, progressive Emma Mulvaney-Stanek, on Monday. Weinberger is a Democrat who chose not to seek a fifth term. He recently sat down with Vermont Edition host Michaela Lafrac for a wide-ranging conversation about his legacy in the Queen City. Weinberger begins by reflecting on the city's struggles with homelessness and a lack of affordable housing.
We are now the state with the second highest homelessness rate of any state in the country. It's been that way for the last couple of years. It's going to be a while until we get to a place where there's enough permanent housing to properly house everybody. We are making progress, but those permanent homes are years away. We have a choice right now. Either we need to acknowledge that we have a problem with homelessness and unsheltered homelessness and dramatically expand our shelter system, Or we are going to continue to see what we've seen the last couple of summers, which is around the state, people sleeping outside in tents, in public areas. The right answer is expanding our shelter capacity. We've done that here in Burlington since 2020. We've created 3 new emergency shelters, but it's not enough. And it shouldn't be Burlington alone that is responding to this homelessness crisis. We need the state to step up and expand shelter capacity as well.
Now, if anybody drives through or walks through the city right now, they will see cranes working on the building at City Place. Construction's going strong, but the Pit still looms in the memories of many Burlingtonians. There was a big empty pit in the middle of the city for many years there, and some of your critics say, why did it take so long for this project to get underway? How do you respond to that?
One thing that I do, if I had the 12 years to do over, Michaela, if I had this project to do over, I would have talked more at the beginning about the uncertainty and the unpredictability of development projects and the possibility of delays and setbacks. And, you know, I prepared for that and we negotiated very protective agreements, but we didn't have as much upfront communication about that. And I think it did surprise and upset the community when we encountered those delays. But, you know, at the end of the day, it is, you know, the tallest building in the state of Vermont is now standing there. And that is a symbol of the amount of economic activity and the amount of revenue that it is going to generate in the years ahead.
Let's look at the rise in opioid overdoses, fentanyl, and drug-related crime. First, what's a strategy that you think the city is undertaking right now that started during your administration that you think is working or holds promise that you'd really like to see continue in the future?
We created this monthly working group that we call Community Stat that has all of the kind of decision makers working on this problem one way or another, whether people in the treatment centers or at the hospital or prosecutors, defense attorneys. We sit at this table and we try to look at the data and make changes in real time. Some of the changes that came out of that, for example, were the hospital changed its prescribing practices. Today, they prescribe about 70% fewer opioids by some measures than they did when that review began. For a couple of years there, Michaela, in 2018 and 2019, it appeared that those changes and some of the others that had come out of that period were working. And we actually saw opioid deaths, overdose deaths drop by 50%. It has been the most heartbreaking setback of my time in office to go from there in 2019 to where we are today in 2024, which is that the problem is essentially worse than ever. Over the course of 22 and 2023, we did launch many new initiatives, some of which we have some hope are succeeding.
Over the course of your tenure as mayor, there has been periods of some major tension around law enforcement, policing, the appointment of current police chief John Murad, including the vote by the city council in 2020 to reduce the size of the police force. Is there anything that you would have done differently as mayor when it comes to law enforcement in the city?
Michaela, I'm proud of my record on law enforcement. We dramatically expanded accountability measures like, you know, Burlington on my watch became one of the first police departments in New England where all officers were had body cameras deployed. We, over the last 12 years, have moved enormously in the direction of transparency, and we have a transparency portal. The Burlington Police Department really leads the way in making metrics and statistics about policing this community available for scrutiny and analysis. And that's why part of why you see them in the news so much is because we put our work out there to be reviewed. But I'm also proud of some of the things you pointed out there as controversial. I believe sometimes as mayor, the way to do this job is to take strong stands, is to go directly at the challenges we face. And, you know, I did that in 2020. I knew that resolution was a mistake as soon as I saw it the Friday before the vote. Good policing requires more resources. And I thought it was a mistake to try to cut spending and reallocate it to other areas. And I said that at the time. Chief Morrison and Chief Murad joined me in opposing that. What do I regret? I regret that we didn't win that debate and that it took me 18 months to get that decision reversed, which was far longer than I ever imagined it would take. But I did ultimately get it reversed. I did get a permanent police chief. And I really think what was hanging in the balance in all those decisions was whether or not we were going to continue to have a police department.
And lastly, Mayor, you haven't made any announcements about what you're going to be doing next, if you're going to be running for a higher office. You know, Phil Scott has yet to announce his plans to run for governor. Are you watching that decision? Does his decision affect yours on what you're going to do next?
After April 1st, I'll be sitting down with my wife, my daughters, and we will be figuring out what's next. And I truly don't know what that is going to be now. What I will say, though, is I am excited for the community. I'm excited for the city. I think it is an exciting time to have a new team coming in, to have Burlington's first woman, first openly queer person serving in this role. And, you know, for the first time in 12 years, I am thinking about new things, establishing new goals, talking to new people. And I'm looking forward to what's ahead.
That was Burlington's outgoing mayor, Merle Weinberger, reflecting on his time in office. You can find his full conversation with Vermont Edition host Michaela LaFrac at vermontpublic.org. And hey, if you're still with me, cries of play ball are ringing throughout Major League Baseball parks today as the 2024 season officially launches. And I have this reminder, especially for fans of the Boston Red Sox, that there is more than one way to take in a game. Here's how the folks who run the Red Sox would like you to do it as their team gets things going with an opening series against the Mariners in Seattle. Casually and without caring who wins. Now, that might seem odd for one of the most storied franchises in league history, but the Red Sox have finished in last place in the American League East three of the last four seasons and look nothing like a team ready to move out of the basement this year. Fans of the other teams in that division, the Yankees, Blue Jays, Rays, and Orioles, are likely taking a different approach, enjoying baseball for its unique qualities as a sport, but also with hopes of getting into the playoffs and making a run at a World Series title. And they have good reason for such aspirations, given that all those squads made improvements to last year's rosters and had, with the exception of the normally powerhouse Yankees, very good 2023 seasons that provided promise for this one. Not so much for the Red Sox, who glaringly had one of the worst pitching staffs in the majors last year. And rather than using the ample funds ownership has to jump into the free agent pool or make trades to try and keep up with the league-wide arms race, instead, they made just one signing of significance, inking free agent Lucas Giolito to a two-year deal. And no offense to the former White Sox pitcher who was an all-star in 2019, but he's had diminishing returns ever since. And one thing we know for sure is that his 2024 season will be even worse, because he won't be able to actually take part in it after blowing out his elbow in spring training. The Red Sox had plenty of opportunities to go after other pitchers before Giolito got hurt and even after he did, but did, what's the opposite of something? Oh, that's right, nothing. So that same starting pitching staff with a collective earned run average near 5 runs per game last season returns, minus one pitcher that may have made them marginally better. The point here is not that the Red Sox had an obligation to spend as wildly as the Los Angeles Dodgers did, committing over $1 billion in total contracts to a team that looked on paper like World Series champions before even a single pitch was thrown. It's that the Red Sox continued to ask their fan base to respond as if they had. The Dodgers will charge their fans the highest average price ticket in the majors this season, but at the same time, they've collected some of the game's best and most exciting players to justify that cost. Two-time league MVP Shohei Ohtani, pitcher Yoshinobu Yamamoto, widely considered to be the best in Japan's professional league, all-star hurler Tyler Glasnow, and Mookie Betts, who used to call Fenway Park home before he was inexplicably traded to L.A., after leading Boston to a World Series title in 2018. Those are just a few of the marquee names LA fans will get to see. Meanwhile, the cheapest seats in Fenway Park are on average nearly $36, which is double the cost of the least expensive tickets charged elsewhere around the league. And while Fenway has the charm and distinction of being the oldest ballpark in the majors, it also comes with some pretty cramped seating and more than a few obstructed views, especially in the right field sections. That's a lot to ask for fans to sit through in order to say they've had the Fenway experience, which is what the guys who run the team are banking on. While co-owner John Henry and his cohorts deserve all kinds of praise for turning around the fortunes of a team that went 86 years between winning championships prior to 2004, they seem to feel that's more than enough and are putting the bulk of their time, effort, and money into their other sports ventures, including ownership of a soccer team across the pond and a car racing group. Hey, it's their money, but I guarantee you, a family of four from Vermont that can maybe afford to see one Red Sox game a year doesn't want to make the trip all the way down to Beantown to watch a squad that would be described charitably as mediocre, only to be told, well, the owners have to make sure Liverpool and RFK Racing have good seasons. That's not a home run pitch to fans, and frankly, given the historic pedigree of the club, it's also a little insulting. No one is saying they have to win the title every year, and spending big bucks on player payroll does not guarantee such an outcome, not even for the deep-pocketed Dodgers. In fact, you could make an argument the Dodgers have to win the World Series this year or their season is a bust. That's a lot of pressure, but Red Sox fans would gladly take it rather than saying, "Who's that guy?" over and over again while scrutinizing the daily lineup card. Boston won't be at Fenway Park for their home opener until April 1st, which seems an appropriate date. April Fool's Day, indeed. In any event, thank you for listening to The Frequency today. We had additional reporting from Peter Hirschfeld, Liam Elder Connors, and Bob Kinzel. Our executive producer is Kevin Trevelyan, and our music is by Blue Dot Sessions. I'm Mitch Wertlieb. I'm off tomorrow, but I'll talk to you next week.
How are we supposed to fix what we don't talk about? Welcome to Homegoings, a Vermont Public podcast that encourages fearless conversations about art and race.
It's like an extended family, and especially around homegoing time.
Join us for Homegoings, wherever you get your podcasts. We're a proud member of the NPR Network.